Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
There's a premise at the heart of the book On Savage Shores, which we're going to talk about today. It was written by the historian Caroline Dodds Pennock. And what she does in the book is take the story of European explorers who discovered the New World, and she flips it. What if it was indigenous Americans who discovered the Old World? It's not a gimmick. It's a way of getting people to imagine the perspective of native people who found themselves in a strange place with strange customs, you know, discovering the place. Of course, many were enslaved and oppressed, and their land was taken from them. But Dodds Pennock says they weren't these passive agents. They had their own deep history and identities and stature.
There's this incredible event in the middle of the 1540s when the Spanish are beginning to establish a foothold in Central and South America. And a Maya chief called Don Juan Apop Batz appears at the court of Prince Philip in Spain in 1545. This has come about because the Spanish have murdered his predecessor. He sees the terrible destruction that's happening in the communities around him. And he decides that the only way to save his community as he sees it is to voluntarily convert to Catholicism. He becomes the first converted Quechi Maya in that region, San Juan Chamelco in Guatemala as it is today. And in conversation with the friars who are in that region, he and a group of other chiefs decide that they should send an embassy to Spain to negotiate with the crown. And so they get together and they gather these incredible gifts for the king. What's most important to them is quetzal, thousands of quetzal feathers, these incredible turquoise feathers, but also all of what they see as the riches of their lands, which includes fruits and vegetables and pottery, and also, which is why the story is most interesting often from our point of view, what becomes one of the foundations of kind of modern food, chocolate, something we're all incredibly familiar with, cacao. And this embassy travels to Spain. They arrive there in the February of 1545, where they appear at the court of Prince Philip. Supposedly, Prince Philip wakes up and he hears the songbirds that they've brought with them, and he rushes to meet Apop Batz. And when he meets them, they're in all their traditional regalia. They have astonishing feathers and beautiful embroidered outfits. And it's quite sparse dress because he says to the Maya, because this is February in Spain, you must be made of steel. He's so admiring of how they're showing all this fortitude by appearing in their traditional dress in this really freezing weather. And among the things that they present to him, this beautiful feathers, these shimmering mountains of feathers, and as well all of these beautiful foods presented on these incredible platters, is drinking chocolate. And this is the first time that we see it being brought, being prepared in Europe. It is by indigenous Maya lords. And at the court, we also have this incredible moment where Philip demands that Apop Batz bows to him. Apop Batz refuses. He says, "I don't bow because I too am a king." That moment, that refusal to submit, has come down in history. It's come down in his local tradition as being an incredibly significant moment where indigenous peoples refused to submit, where they insisted on being recognized as equal. And that scene is so significant that Philip apparently is very impressed. He respects Arpotbats because of that. And he gives him huge amounts of treasures to take back with him, including the silver bells, which all but one that sank into a marsh on the way, still hang in the church at Chimalco today. I think it's incredibly important because it is a moment when Indigenous peoples are quite clearly making voluntary choices to travel to Europe, to engage in colonial politics on a transatlantic scale, and to petition the Spanish Crown, not just as subjects, but also in some cases as equals. And that diplomatic aspect, that deliberate engagement with the colonial bureaucracy, not just on their own shores, but also transatlantically, is so often forgotten. It is the case that the vast majority of people who came to Spain and to the rest of Europe in this early period are there through various forms of coercion, either as enslaved people or as servants or subjects or people who've been brought or taken, kind of these tricky words that we have to look out for that obscure so much violence. But then we also have many hundreds and even thousands of voluntary diplomats who are travelling as representatives of families, of communities, of elites, but also of wider Indigenous peoples, and are active partners in this colonial world.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. That's Caroline Dodds Panic. She's a senior lecturer in international history at the University of Sheffield. Her book is On Savage Shores. It's just been published on paperback. And she describes it as the story of the people who traveled the other way.
As a historian of the Indigenous world in particular, I worked on the Aztec Mexica people. I started working on that in the 90s. And as a historian working in Europe on Indigenous American peoples, I began to wonder why we heard so much about Europeans going west and so little about Indigenous peoples coming the other way. And the more I started looking for them in my research, the more I realized there were huge numbers of these peoples. Now, I'm not the first person to notice these travelers. There have been many, many actually scholars, Indigenous knowledge keepers, and others who've highlighted some of these various travelers. But what really astonished me about it was how, despite the fact that we do have quite a few scholarly works on this subject, the presence of Indigenous peoples as part of the British and the European past more broadly just doesn't seem to have dented the popular or even the scholarly imagination to any great degree, except very occasionally under the banner of curiosities. And I was so struck by that when I started looking into it that that was what led to this book.
Say something about how you've kind of inverted the word savage in the title. As you say in the book, these were people who, in quotes, explored, who went on journeys of, in quotes, you know, discovery. Say more about that idea, because you're just sort of twisting, you're turning the idea. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I thought really hard about whether to use the word savage in the title of the book. In the title, of course, the savage shore is Europe.
Yeah.
This isn't a reference to Indigenous peoples, but I am very aware that it's a racial slur. So I talk to Indigenous friends and colleagues, and there were differences of opinion about it. And I certainly was very careful in using the term in the book when it's in quoted, you know, when Europeans of the time use it to refer to Indigenous people. Mm. But the reality is that it is a way that people in the early modern period are understanding the Americas. And I just thought it was so important to really deliberately take that on and to confront the idea that Europe itself would have at that time by many Indigenous visitors been perceived as savage in just the way that Europeans were imposing these kind of belief structures. Now, that's not to say, of course, that indigenous communities have no inequalities, but what they tend to lack is that extreme poverty, which so characterizes some aspects of European society at that time.
Give us a sense, if you would, about the truth is there were, as you say in the book, thousands and thousands of indigenous people in Europe from as early as the 1490s, and that they were not just insignificant oddities. Can you give us a sense of the numbers here, the indigenous people who found themselves in Europe in this era?
Oh, the numbers are a tricky question. Huh. Because while we have good records for some indigenous travelers to Europe, they are very definitely underreported and underrecorded. And so to some extent, I have fudged the numbers a little bit in the book in talking about thousands or tens of thousands of indigenous people. So we know that there are, as a minimum, tens of thousands because, for example, there is an extremely extensive trade in enslaved people transatlantically. Columbus alone trades 6,000 enslaved indigenous people into Europe. So we must be talking about very large numbers. But after 1542, when the trade in enslaved people is made largely illegal, they start to become much more obscure in the records, hidden under words like loro, meaning brown, rather than acknowledged as indio, the Spanish word for indigenous or Indian, obviously. Now, you also have smaller numbers going to Britain. They are well recorded, but they are in small numbers. And then you have quite a lot of people going to places like France and the lowlands as part of the Brazilian trade. The book goes up to the founding of Jamestown, which is the reason for that being that it's a moment of change, a moment when the relationship changes. I mean, as a historian, you have to pick an end date, right? But also that first 100 years or so of the encounter is far more a time, I think, when indigenous people have more influence in this transatlantic space because the empires aren't quite as well established. They haven't got their claws into the territory to the same extent. What that means, though, is that quite a lot of the people that I'm talking about, the numbers I'm talking about, we are talking about people who go to Portugal and Spain. And we know that there are tens of thousands of people enslaved, at least. When you start to track individual people, my own numbers for people with names are into the hundreds. And that's just the tip of an iceberg. But unfortunately, much like the iceberg, an awful lot of it is invisible.
Let's back up to I thought it would be interesting to, before we get to indigenous people in Europe, let's just talk about, as you do in the book, their own reaction, their own impression of these white travelers who arrive. I mean, the impression is, of course, that they were sort of bowed by the countenance and refinement of these people. But it's more complicated than that. Because what you do in the book is you also give us a sense of just how vast and how diverse and how sophisticated these people were, the number of languages, the different kinds of cultural rituals and ideas. Talk a little bit about, you know, writing and law and astronomy and medicine. Talk a little bit about that part of the story.
The Americas, before the arrival of Europeans, is to a modern audience almost unimaginably diverse, I think. We are talking about thousands of different indigenous tribes, communities, cities, peoples. Mexico alone has hundreds of indigenous languages. There are more than 60 recognized languages just in Mexico today. And there were many more that were wiped out. You have very highly developed by European standards, urban civilizations. You have mobile peoples. You have peoples living lightly on the land, which is a problem for archaeologists, but who have, for example, summer homes and winter homes. You have farming communities. You have hunting communities. You have societies like the Aztecs and the Maya that have astonishingly rich pictographic records that are almost all destroyed. You know, it's like the destruction of the Library of Alexandria with the Spanish invasion. You have this rich literature, and then all across the continent, incredibly rich oral traditions and cultures which encompass everything from law to entertainment to news to behavioral codes. It is just astonishing how diverse these communities are, while at the same time having some commonalities, of course, and shared values in various regions and places. People often frame the encounter in terms of Europeans versus indigenous people, or just in terms of the particular empires. But even if you think of just one empire, they are already encountering hundreds of different peoples with hundreds of different languages. It's almost ridiculous now to think of the confidence that we've been led to imagine they have going into these communities with absolutely no idea who they're talking to, even if they might have an interpreter from a neighbouring community. It doesn't necessarily help them here. And Indigenous peoples outnumber Europeans in most of the Americas up until the 18th century. This is still Indigenous territory until much later than we're often led to imagine.
Caroline Dodds Pennock, her book is called On Savage Shores, How Indigenous Americans Discovered Europe. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're inverting the story of the discovery of the New World. What if it were indigenous people who discovered Europe, not the other way around? The historian Caroline Dodds Pennock says thousands of native people from the Western Hemisphere crossed the sea and found themselves in an exotic, strange, and savage world that they explored and changed. She describes it as the story of the people who traveled the other way. Her book is called On Savage Shores. Did these people who were indigenous to the Western Hemisphere, did they think about venturing across the waters for exploration in the real sense, right? And for commerce or science. I mean, I understand they made their ways to Europe in various ways, and maybe not mostly, but certainly many times by coercion or force. But did they, as far as we know, venture out and explore or think of venturing out independent of all of that? Do we know?
It's very hard to be sure because we are lacking sources, not for indigenous points of view more generally, although they are vastly outweighed by sources for European points of view, but sources specifically about indigenous travel and how people thought about that. What we do know is that after the arrival of Europeans, they do start to change the way they think about the great waters of the Atlantic and the Pacific and about the possibilities that they offer. We know that there are some people who travel to Europe, as far as we can tell, just as sort of tourists. They want to see what's there. Yeah. There are people who travel as ambassadors. There are people who travel as scouts, it seems very likely, who are sent deliberately to find out the capacity of these Europeans and why it is that they have come. The idea of exploration, I don't know how much that plays, but we do know that the indigenous world before the arrival of Europeans had long distance trade networks all around the coast of Central South America and out into the Caribbean and all across North America. They had very extensive trade networks, so they must have been geared up for discovery, for long-distance travel and trade. Archaeology tells us that. What it doesn't tell us is how much trade passes through different hands as opposed to individuals traveling over long distances. But it's certainly the case that when the Europeans arrive from quite early on, you have people, as well as the majority, who are coerced, volunteering to travel and wanting to travel in order to see what's on the other side of the Atlantic, or for, like our pop bats, for really specific reasons.
You write about how they sort of conceived of the world beyond their lands, this transatlantic landscape. And there are these songs that some indigenous groups would sing to get a sense of how they saw the world on the other side of the ocean. Say something about these, in particular, the water pouring song.
The Cantares Mexicanos, yeah, which are a collection of Nahuatl songs. It means the songs of the Mexicans, and they are the recorded version of an indigenous oral tradition that existed before the arrival of the Spanish and was used for entertainment, but also to communicate news, religion, politics, all kinds of everyday actions and activities, as well as elite ones, are communicated through these stories. And among them, we have recorded a song that talks about travels to Europe, travels across the Great Water. And what's fascinating is how their understanding of that water has evolved in this period. Because before the arrival of Europeans, the indigenous Mexica people, you probably know them as the Aztecs, thought that the world was surrounded by water. Not the idea of the water pouring off the edges, but rather more like a globe, that the water reaches to the sky. And they clearly still do see a spiritual dimension to crossing the ocean. In this song, on the other side of the Atlantic in Europe, they seem to believe that the suckling tree, which is where all the Aztec babies come from, is still on that other side of the water. It really is, as you would imagine it, little babies kind of hanging, suckling from the tree. It's quite a cute image. And this is where they believe babies come from. They believe that is on the other side of the water. They also know quite clearly that the emperor and the pope are on the other side of the water. But in some sense, they seem to think that God is there too. And when they talk about the great basilica in Rome, they seem to have imagined it both as a place of political power and spiritual power, but also as a kind of womb, almost again as a place of rebirth. And now these are very metaphorical texts. Much has clearly been lost to us about how we should interpret them. And they do lose something just by being recorded by a European intermediary. But at the same time, you get this wonderfully rich sense that specific stories, because it mentions Don Martin in the story, a man called Don Martin, who, even if we just take the three most famous Don Martins by that point, and there were lots and lots of other Martins, it could be any one of three very famous travelers called Martin. So that's no help. But what we do know is that they're being used to talk about these specific travels, but then to frame them within this indigenous way of understanding the world, which is at the same time reaching back to their beliefs and evolving to cope with this new situation.
So there's this legal fiction, as you've described it, this privilege that Europeans created to justify their treatment of native peoples. It's the doctrine of discovery. Talk to us about how it worked exactly.
The doctrine of discovery is, as you say, a legal fiction that Europeans invent to give themselves and their descendants the rights to territories which they discover. It's not a term that's used in this period. It's much later that it makes its way into common usage in that form and into US law, as you may know. But it has its roots in this period, in the 15th century papal bulls that divide the world between Spain and Portugal. So what happens is that in the 1400s, Portugal have been exploring in Africa, on the west coast of Africa. And so they had gone to the Pope and said, we want our rights to these lands confirmed. And the Pope issues a bull which gives them the rights to these lands on condition they evangelize them. So when Columbus bumps into the Bahamas, as they are now, one of the first things that happens when he comes back to Europe and tells Ferdinand and Isabella, the monarchs of what is now Spain, that he's found these lands, is that they go to the Pope and ask for their right to have these lands confirmed, even before they know that the mainland continents of the Americas are there. They go to ask for a papal bull equivalent to the one given to Portugal. And so they're given the rights to everything west of a line in the Atlantic on condition that they evangelize it. Now, what this effectively does is to make indigenous peoples non-existent. They don't matter for these bulls. They don't count, except in as much as they are subject to be evangelized. And that has had a really powerful legacy in the Americas. I'm sure you're familiar with ideas like the disappearing Indian, as it's often called, the idea that indigenous peoples have vanished from the land, or that their absence somehow has entitled Europeans to take it over, completely ignoring the fact that there were many millions of indigenous peoples there when Europeans arrived, and that many of those who no longer on their lands were forcibly and violently displaced or else died of violence, diseases and enslavement, community breakdown and so on, all compounded by colonialism or in some cases by deliberate genocides. This idea that indigenous peoples exist only as subjects for colonization is really strong, and for evangelization, it's really, really strong in European, especially in Catholic ways of thinking. By the time, of course, you get the Protestant powers coming into North America, these are much more commercial enterprises. But the doctrine of discovery, this idea that whoever gets there first has the rights to that territory, remains incredibly powerful in European law, in the roots of international law, which are being founded around this time. Only the year after the Pope gives the papal bull giving the Americas to Spain, Spain and Portugal sit down and they agree a thing called the Treaty of Tordesillas, which splits the world in a little bit further, actually, to the west, because Portugal think they've been hard done by. And what happens is they chop off Brazil. This is how Brazil comes to end up with the Portuguese. Now, at that time, they say in the treaty that they're going to get the Pope to confirm it. But by only about 30 years later, treaties like that are being written with no reference to the papacy. The religious aspect of this is diminishing. And it just sets the stage for things like the Great Game, as it's called, which happen later, where powers divide up territories with lines on maps.
The ironic twist, or one of them anyway, is that since, I guess, the Spanish have to regard these indigenous people as potential converts and Christians, they have to see them, therefore, as fully human and therefore shouldn't be enslaved, at least not in principle, right? That's how it worked.
Yeah, it's quite a paradox, because you at the same time have this erasing of indigenous agency and power and political rights. And at the same time, you have to recognize that people are potential converts, and therefore to accord them the status, as you say, of fully human souls. And also to give them what is called dominion, rights to territory and to power as rulers in the event that they convert to Christianity. And so in some ways, Spain does seek in official terms to protect indigenous peoples. In the early years, you're not allowed to enslave indigenous people except under three specific circumstances. There are loopholes, of course, in the law. Now, the loopholes are gradually tightened. Laws are imposed to, for example, prevent children or women being enslaved. And then in 1542, they bring in a thing called the New Laws, or that's what they're known now, which theoretically bans enslavement under all circumstances. But the problem is that it still goes on. Justifications are still made. And even so, those Spanish rules applied only to people in Spanish territories. That said, the Spanish crown do make, perhaps to us, surprisingly dedicated attempts to act as defenders of indigenous peoples. Ferdinand and Isabella, of course, who are the rulers when Columbus arrives in the Americas, are clearly very divided on this opinion. Isabella is always telling Columbus off. Who is this man, she says, who tries to enslave my vassals?
Right.
As soon as she dies, Ferdinand goes around issuing licenses for enslaving all over the place. So he's clearly been being restrained by her. So it has a lot to do with who's in power and how much they are committed to the mission of Catholicism.
Caroline Dodds Pennock, we're talking about her book on Savage Shores, How Indigenous Americans Discovered Europe. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Caroline Dodds Pennock. We're talking about her book on Savage Shores. You referred to this story you tell that even people who know a lot about the Tudor period didn't know that there was a Brazilian king who was in the court, or at least at the court of King Henry VIII. I wish we knew more about what Henry VIII made of this Brazilian king and what the king made of the court. It doesn't seem like we do know much about that moment, or do we?
No, unfortunately, we have only one source for this. There's no reason to doubt it in particular. What happens is that in 1531, a man called William Hawkins, a very rich man, a merchant, a sea captain, one of the first people to trade regularly across the Atlantic. He returned from his second voyage to Brazil in 1531. The record we have is the story told by his son to Richard Hakluyt, the famous chronicler. And he apparently brought with him at that time what he called one of the savage kings of the country of Brazil. Now, this man seems to be a voluntary traveller because they have agreed to leave behind a man called Martin Cockerham as a pledge for the safe return of the Brazilian king. He is most likely a Tupi man from the Bahia coast, and he stays in England for nearly a year. And we do know that he made a huge impression on the court. He had cheek piercings with bone ornaments, which were a symbol of his bravery. He had pierced lower lip. And according to the son of Hawkins, his behavior, his gestures, and his appearance were all seen as very strange to beholders. Mm-hmm. Now, he lived there in England for almost a year before deciding to return home. And we can only, this is where I really, like you say, I want to be able to say more about him. I want to be able to say more about why he was there, though presumably he was there because he wanted to know where these men had come from and who they were, because as far as we can tell, it was a voluntary voyage and he was the ruler of his people. But we have to imagine even where they met, because Henry's palace doesn't survive anymore. We have to imagine what they did, what they talked about. He does seem to have developed enough English that they could have some kind of conversation. If he was there nearly a year, you'd imagine. Unfortunately, like so many Indigenous people, he dies before he can return home. He dies on the transatlantic voyage home. And they are apparently able to convince his people of their fair doing because Martin Cockerham is released.
You know, there's this coda to that chapter you write about this. It's just a few sentences where you say that these, as you put it, these Indigenous visitors, like the Brazilian king, saw Europe as a savage shore as much as a center of political gravity. And it made me think about this thing that comes up kind of again and again in the book, where you had these people who were there, some voluntarily, most of them not really, but being gawked at by the Europeans. And they were always just staring back. You know, they, as you say in the book, they gazed back at their audiences. They were as mystified by this culture as the Europeans were of them. That seems like an important idea, I think, for this story.
Yes, far too often Indigenous people in Europe and also in their homelands during this period are described as objects of curiosity rather than as people who possess curiosity in their own right. Now, of course, there is much rich work now which is challenging those ideas. Many Indigenous communities talking about the reactions of their own people to the arrival of Europeans. We are starting to change that story, but still far too often Indigenous people in Europe are seen just through the lens of curiosity. They're seen as a spectacle, as something strange and different. And there are some incredible stories where they are quite deliberately framed as curiosities. The building of an entire Tupi village on the banks of the River Seine at Rouen in France, for example, this astonishing village with 50 Indigenous Tupi Brazilian people. That is a remarkable spectacle, and there is no other word for it. But you don't have to see it only through the lens of spectacle, because you have to say, what were those people doing there? These are people who were allied with the French in Brazil at that time, while other Indigenous communities were allied with the Portuguese. One of the people witnessing the village at Rouen, this incredible spectacle with trees painted red to look like Brazilwood trees and Indigenous huts and pretending to chop Brazilwood and tiny monkeys that have been parakeets that have been brought specially, this remarkable diplomatic show which is witnessed by the French king and his wife and his mistress and lots of ambassadors, including the Portuguese ambassador. One of the big elements of this is a display of the Indigenous Tupi people defeating their enemies who are allied with the Portuguese. It's a political spectacle. And it's not just a political spectacle on the part of the French against the Portuguese. These people are demonstrating their allegiance to the French. They're showing why they're useful. They build a fort on the river and demonstrate the trade, which is so important to Rouen at that time, the trade in Brazilwood and how it's done. And then we see this military victory, this battle between the Tupinambá and the Tabajará, these two communities, or rather, presumably, all French-allied people pretending to be these two groups. They mock up this battle. And nobody ever says, what did they think they were doing here? Are they being forced to do this? Or are they participating willingly? And they would have had every interest in demonstrating their allegiance to the French, which was absolutely vital in South America at that time, because the French were the only thing in many areas holding off the Portuguese slave traders. People always see this particular Tupi village in Rouen as part of French politics and as part of spectacle, but they never ask, how does this sit as part of Tupi politics?
You have a section of the book devoted to the, as you say, the stuff of Indigenous life, which really gives us a sense of what Indigenous people valued or how they talked about the value of stuff. I mean, one of the things you mentioned, when Columbus, for example, first met the Taino people, one of the first things he did was trade with them. And he wrote that they bartered like idiots, like his sense of what they valued. What did he mean, and what did he see, and what did Indigenous people value?
What Columbus meant was that they were prepared to exchange things he considered of high value for things he considered of low value. Yeah. So he would give them beads and glass and knives, and they would give him gold or pearls, things that he considered to be extremely high value. But he's not thinking about how they might frame value.
Yeah.
I would be a little bit careful with this. I think I have a footnote to this effect. Of course, if you start saying Europeans value everything through the lens of trade and Indigenous people value things in spiritual terms or in terms of the synchronicity or the exchange, the ways that it matters to them within their communities, then of course you're stereotyping, aren't you? Talked about the diversity of Indigenous peoples. There's no such thing as an Indigenous value system. There are many, many, just as there are many European value systems. But what we definitely see is that when Europeans arrive, they have a much stronger focus on commercial exchange, where the indigenous peoples have more of a focus on exchange through the lens of gift giving, through alliance, and also they value things differently. So gold is not in many indigenous communities valued as highly as, for example, quetzal feathers, as we talked about with Don Juan Apotbatz and his embassy. The thing that they take the point of recording, the thing they make the point of recording, is the quetzal feathers. It's not anything else. They say, I brought 2,000 and he brought 600. That's the thing that they value most highly. And so often we find it hard to disentangle these transatlantic exchanges from ideas of commerce. And that's partly because the records suit themselves very well to telling histories about commerce, because trade is recorded. Whether it's trade in people or trade in stuff, it's really well recorded. But we've let that ubiquity of the idea of trade also seep into other things. So everything we talk about in terms of transatlantic exchange, we talk about commodities, we talk about consumption and production, we talk about products. And I wanted to try, albeit partially, to disentangle that stuff to some extent from those narratives of commerce. And that was how the chapter ended up being called The Stuff of Life. Because I couldn't come up with a word other than stuff. And for a long time, I just wanted to talk about stuff. And my agent said, you can't call it stuff. I said, well, but what is the neutral word? Because commodities isn't a neutral word. Products isn't a neutral word. What do I call it? And I was very pleased when I came up with Stuff of Life.
Well, I think it's interesting how, as you say, their ideas of value were varied. They had complex systems. They were different. There was not one monolithic idea. I mean, but there did seem to be some common theme or ideology that was based on a connection to land and natural environment. That did seem to be something that was held in common, don't you think?
I think certainly held in common to the vast majority of indigenous cultures, even to cultures like the Aztec Mexica people, where you have quite a developed system of commerce and of wealth. Although even in that society, you have redistribution of resources. The vast majority of indigenous cultures, I'm always careful of the word every, because there are exceptions to every rule and there are so many communities we don't know about anymore. But certainly the vast majority of indigenous cultures before the arrival of Europeans seem to have held in common a worldview that is more informed by a spirit of reciprocity.
We only have a few more minutes left. I was hoping for one last story. And it's the last story, in fact, that you tell in the book of an Inuk woman and her child kidnapped. Tell us the story, if you would.
This is the story that actually has stuck with me most over thousands of lives, many of them remarkable and distinctive, tragic. For whatever reason, this has really held with me. And one of the reasons for that is that we have a picture of these people from life. John White, who is famous for his drawings of the northeastern woodland peoples of what is now the United States, drew a picture of what looks like two Inuk people in their sealskin clothing. But if you look very closely, you can see that it's not two people, it's three. Inside the hood of the woman, there is a man and a woman, is a baby just peeking out from his mother's hood. That baby is an Inuk child that we know as Nutak, most probably a boy, though we're not sure. His mother, Arnak, their names actually just mean woman and child. That's all they're recorded in the sources, came with the man, Kalicho, who is not the father of the family, though is sometimes mistakenly identified like that. He's a stranger to them. But the three of them come together to Bristol in England in 1577. They are kidnapped as part of an English expedition to what is now often called Baffin Island, Kikiktaluk. And they are kidnapped and brought to Bristol. And they become a spectacle from the very beginning. So Kalicho paddles up and down the River Avon at Bristol at high tide and shows how he hunts seals by harpooning ducks, which is a kind of amusing vignette, but it really serves to cover up the tragedy of what is happening to them. Calicho dies not long after this. He has been suffering with headaches and deafness since he arrived. And incredibly, we have the records of his autopsy by a doctor called Dodding, who treated Calicho during his last days. Frobisher, who is the man who led the expedition that kidnapped them, the Cathay Company pays for the doctor, and we have a record of the autopsy. The autopsy shows that he was suffering from broken ribs, which have punctured a lung, presumably from injuries sustained during his capture, and also that he has a head injury. What's incredible is that Dodding also talks about having treated him during his last days, and he diagnoses him with a thing called anglophobia, which sounds in its description much like a man putting a brave face on an absolutely appalling situation. For reasons that are not clear in retrospect, he forces Arnak to watch Calicho's dissected remains being buried in order to reassure her that the English are not cannibals. Why this would be a reassuring, or why she would have thought this in the first place, goodness only knows. He describes her blankness during this, which he puts down to a lack of sensitivity, but which is presumably more likely shock or trauma, or again, putting on a brave face in this appalling situation. Arnak herself is already ill by this point, probably with measles, and she dies not long after Calicho. Both of them are buried at a church that still stands in Bristol called St. Stephen's by the river, and their names are recorded in the parish register. They're recorded as burials in that year. Nutak himself is also ill by this point, probably of the measles that had killed his mother, and he is taken to London, still nursing, probably only around 15 months old at this time. He must have been absolutely terrified. He's incredibly vulnerable, taken to London, and it seems put on display in a place called the Three Swans Pub, where in the heart of a place that even at that time considered itself one of the most civilized in the world, he was gawked at by curious Londoners while dying, not to put too fine a point on it. And he is then buried at a church called St. Olave's, which again still stands in the city of London. His name, though, is not recorded in the parish records. He is unremarked, and his remains are not marked. Incredibly, he's not even the first of his people to be buried at St. Olave's. A year before, an Inukman was brought, again kidnapped by Frobisher, was brought to England and had been depicted from life again, and had a wax mask of him, and had again died, and had been buried in an unmarked grave at St. Olave's. One of the things that's most striking about this story for me is that the reason St. Olave's is so famous is that it's the worship and burial place of Samuel Pepys, who is an incredibly well-known diarist, of course. If you know anything about Samuel Pepys, you'll know that we know more about him than we might want to sometimes from his own writings. And his face glares out at his wife across the nave. Her face is also carved into the other side of the nave. They're very striking figures, very hugely prominent in our imagination of this point of history, left an enormous amount of writings about himself, very well marked in the church. And then nearby, Tiny Nutak, about whom we know very little, not even his own name, unremarked in the parish records, his grave unmarked, and who appears only sort of briefly in our histories. And that juxtaposition of those two lives almost epitomized for me the story of the book, the way that we see some parts of history, some voices so clearly, while others are so obscured or even go unheard when they are there to be found and listened to. And yeah, it for me, that story of Tiny Nutak is the one that I found hardest to forget. His face, his story is the one that has most stayed with me.
Caroline Dodds Panic, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on to talk about the book.
Caroline Dodds Panic, she's a senior lecturer in international history at the University of Sheffield. Her book is called On Savage Shores, How Indigenous Americans Discovered Europe. The book has just been released on paperback, and we should mention her publisher is offering a free copy to Indigenous libraries and community centers. You can send her an email if you're interested. We have her address on our webpage. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Tomorrow, we'll preview the political landscape here in Utah as we head into the final weeks of the election season. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.